in wildfire season, sometimes when it gets really intense, we sort of casually say, like, oh, it feels like the end of the world, or, you know, we remember sometimes, I don't know who we is, but anyway, I do sometimes, and folks that I know do sometimes, remember some of the images in ancient texts around the disasters that happen near what we might call the end of the world. In the Buddhist system, there's one, maybe we'll read it soon. There's a text on what's called the Seven Suns, where there's a text that says that essentially the end of the world happens when there's a drought, and it's kind of a heat end, and these different suns appear one after the other, seven of them, each one kind of hotter and more destructive than the last. And it's a vision of the end of the planet. So there's a few of these within the Buddhist tradition that speak to, in a sense, how we might understand what happens when things go poorly, and or when goodness or the maintenance of life reaches its end, reaches its karmic end. And because the Buddhist teachings are, you know, in a way relentlessly about ethics, many of these teachings hinge on ethics as, in a way, like the thing that went wrong. And so I, with the fires raging up north and down south, and a week in which the corruption drama in our government is at a fever pitch, we might say. And just so people in the distant future listening to the recording know what we're talking about, we might say that this is the week of the deadliest fire in California history, the Camp Fire up north, outside of Chico, burned the entire town of Paradise. Paradise has burned down. Hashtag not a metaphor. And the president just fired Jeff Sessions, so the idea that he's kind of trying to manipulate the investigation and cheat in all sorts of ways. So I brought you a text about the unrighteousness of rulers giving rise to the destruction of the environment. And this is both a very classic Buddhist kind of critique of what happens when one is ethical, especially when someone in power is unethical. But in an interesting way, as I was kind of reading it just before coming over, there's a way that it echoes in an interesting way a familiar teaching from a parallel tradition, which is that it echoes in an interesting way an aspect of the opening chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as well, from the Vedanta tradition. So I'm going to read you a story, an ancient story about the conditions for things to go well and to go poorly. This is from the discourses known as the Numbered Discourses, the Anguttara Nikaya, from the chapter on the fours. So lists of four. This is called When Kings Are Unrighteous. When kings are unrighteous, the royal vassals become unrighteous. When royal vassals are unrighteous, Brahmins and householders become unrighteous. When Brahmins and householders are unrighteous, the people of the towns and countryside become unrighteous. When the people of the towns and countryside are unrighteous, the sun and moon proceed off course. When the sun and moon proceed off course, the constellations and the stars proceed off course. When the constellations and the stars proceed off course, day and night proceed off course. The months and fortnights proceed off course. The seasons and years proceed off course. When the seasons and years proceed off course, the winds blow off course and at random. When the winds blow off course and at random, the deities become upset. When the deities are upset, sufficient rain does not fall. When sufficient rain does not fall, the crops ripen irregularly. When people eat crops that ripen irregularly, they become short-lived, ugly, weak, and sickly. So this is, in a way, a very classic telling, first of all, of how central or important in a system the figure of power is. So when the king is unethical, unrighteous, it trickles down, as it were, to everyone else, to the ministers, to the people, ultimately to all the people of the realm, including the ordinary people, who follow in this kind of archetypal system, who follow the example of their leaders, right? Oh, it's like, oh, well, if the rich do it, like, I can do it. And so then the people who are prominent in the public eye are lie or cheat or steal. And of course, the ordinary person who, in a sense, even unconsciously, learns the moral order from those who are in charge, then sees that that's all right to do so, that that's right to do so. So that, in a way, makes sense, perhaps in a straightforward way, as, you know, a community or a nation or a culture. But then the text makes, you know, the amazing leap that the classical texts, you know, often make. When the people of the towns and countryside are unrighteous, the sun and moon proceed off course. And from there, it spreads out to be like all the weather, the constellations, and then the rain doesn't come, and the crops are poor, and the people are unhealthy. The concept that human activity was, and human moral activity was necessary to keep the ecosystem rolling, and the weather on course and the crops producing, is, of course, a very, very ancient idea in South Asian culture. And in a way, it's the core of the Vedic ritual that the Buddha, in many cases, is resisting or redefining or recontextualizing or rebelling against or ignoring in different ways. In the Vedic system, the sense was that, you know, the order of the cosmos was maintained when people work the land, bringing wealth to their rulers, who give that wealth to the priests, who perform the fire sacrifice, that feeds some of that wealth to the gods, who then are nourished by that ritual and by the proper singing of the chants and the devotional hymns, and who then are sustained in their offices of being the rain and the sun and the wind and the crop and the water and all of the forces that make the grain ripen and the people harvest it. And there's this virtuous cycle. In the Buddha's time, and the Buddha is part of this rebellion against this system, that in some ways is thought of as a rebellion against a priestly caste, that it wouldn't be necessary to support this class of professional ritual experts, but that instead of the maintenance of the ecosystem through ritual, liberation in the Buddhist system was found by a kind of disengagement from action, the end of action, rather than the maintenance of virtuous action. But the end of action is then reconfigured as a certain kind of action. In the Vedic system, it was the maintenance of the ritual and the chanting that was action. The word karma originally referred to the action of the ritual, the fire sacrifice, the yajna, or homa. And for the Buddha, that the word karma gets shifted in its meaning to refer to ethical action. Ethical action is what produces future existence, ethical or unethical action, the intention toward ethical and unethical action. So then the Buddha kind of turns this doctrine of action, maintaining the ecosystem, on its head, makes ethics the center rather than the ritual the center. And then we get a text like this that very interestingly, even though ethics is the center, right, when the king behaves unrighteously, all this stuff goes wrong. It still does the same maneuver of hooking it into the ecosystem, saying, like, when that happens, all the people fall away from morality, and then the ecosystem crumbles. The sun and the moon go off course, the stars go off course, the seasons go off course, the rain doesn't come, the crops wither. And so there's still this mysterious way that, you know, the actions of the ruler are of ecosystem importance. And so, of course, now let's flash to, you know, our contemporary predicament. And of course, we can notice that if we have, you know, taken a look, for instance, at the science behind climate change, one might be forgiven for thinking that the entire thing is the problem is caused by men's greed. That, like, you know, greed for resources has despoiled, to use the old biblical term, despoiled the earth. Two wonderful friends of mine from school were part of a project that they called Becoming Ecosexuals, where they were lovers with the earth. And they would do all these performance art projects, and Beth Stevens, who's a performance artist and an academic from Santa Cruz, and her wife Annie Sprinkle, who once was a porn actress and then became a performance artist as well, and together they've been doing this incredible, beautiful performance artwork, essentially bringing consciousness to ecological and environmental issues, but through this kind of amazing, charged, beautiful, funny, sexy performance art, being ecosexuals. And they made a movie called Goodbye Gauli Mountain, where they road tripped together to Beth's hometown in West Virginia, I think, where the mountaintops had been removed. Mountaintop removal, one of the kind of most horrifying ways to mine in the Appalachians, and just the entire tops of mountains cut off. Mountains that were, you know, that some of which were sacred to indigenous people, of course, and all of which were lovely mountains, that then became run off into streams and toxic streams, and really the profound destruction of the environment. And we can think about what we know about, you know, things like fracking and carbon in the atmosphere and all of this, and we might think about those images that we all, whatever our position on them, have heard for our whole lives, all of the effects of the fossil fuel industry and the extractive industries. When leaders and the powerful are unrighteous, the people become unrighteous. What does unrighteous mean here? You know, there's some way that in the Buddhist system, everything in terms of harmful action comes down to the core defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed, particularly in this sense, is what I hear in part, where, because some of what you know, some of what rulers do is collect resources. That's sort of the jam if you're a king or a royal vassal. And so greed, kind of metastasizing among the powerful, here is what is really the thing that throws the whole system off balance. And in a certain way, I don't have any profound teaching about this other than to say it looks like that is still absolutely the case in any sense that I can assess in our world. This feels quite accurate. And then it gets back down to the people and it says, when people eat crops that ripen irregularly, they become short-lived, ugly, weak, and sickly. I don't love that the text throws ugly in with the other markers of ill health. That's a conceit in this genre of literature that healthy and beautiful go together. Apparently that's a very old idea. But certainly the sickly part. And again, all we have to do is look around and we see sickliness, weakness. The rest of the text just plays this out by telling its opposite. So I'll just read the passage for the music of it. It's just the reverse of that first passage. But when kings are righteous, the royal vassals become righteous. When the royal vassals are righteous, Brahmins and householders become righteous. When Brahmins and householders are righteous, the people of the towns and countryside become righteous. When the people of the towns and countryside are righteous, the sun and moon proceed on course. When the sun and moon proceed on course, the constellations and the stars proceed on course. When the constellations and the stars proceed on course, day and night proceed on course. The months and fortnights proceed on course. The seasons and years proceed on course. When the seasons and years proceed on course, the winds blow on course and dependably. When the winds blow on course and dependably, the deities do not become upset. When the deities are not upset, sufficient rain falls. When sufficient rain falls, the crops ripen in season. When people eat crops that ripen in season, they become long-lived, beautiful, strong, and healthy. And then the text, as a certain kind of literary genre in the suttas often does, repeats the same thing poetically in verse. When cattle are crossing a ford, if the chief bull goes crookedly, all the others go crookedly, because their leader has gone crookedly. So too, among human beings, when the one considered the chief behaves unrighteously, other people do so as well. The entire kingdom is dejected if the king is unrighteous. I like dejected. I'm dejected right now. My king is unrighteous. When cattle are crossing a ford, if the chief bull goes straight across, because their leader has gone straight, all the others go straight across. So too among human beings, when the one considered the chief conducts himself righteously, other people do so as well. The entire kingdom rejoices if the king is righteous. If America is an example, about 48% of the country rejoices when the king is righteous, but I'll take it. So this made me think about this text that is not an exact parallel, but an interesting one. In the opening chapter of the Gita, the Blessed Song, the story of the great war at the heart of the Indian national epic, the Mahabharata, the text opens with the great warrior Arjuna on the eve of this world-destroying battle that's going to decimate the armies and populations on both sides, with his cousin and driver, chariot driver, Krishna, who he doesn't know is God, Vishnu, yet. It takes him 9 chapters to figure out that his driver is God. But in the opening chapter, Arjuna has Krishna drive him out to the center of the field where the armies are assembling before dawn, and he pauses there and he sees the moment before battle, and in a way that reflects what I think is a very human and wise response to war, which is he doesn't like it. He says, "I don't like this. This doesn't look good. People are going to kill their own relatives. The people heading the armies on both sides are two sets of extended brothers, basically." Stepbrothers or half brothers, and to boot, the worst of the offenses is that the good guy brothers, the Pandavas, and the bad guy brothers, the Kauravas, all had the same teacher or guru, and the guru is fighting on the bad guy's side today. So the good guys, in order to win, would have to kill their own guru, which is the worst sin, basically. I mean, they're killing their own brothers, and then it's just bad all around. And the text says that Arjuna, looking around, he says, "This is so wrong. Like when people kill their own brethren and teachers, the whole social order is disrupted, is broken, and everything falls apart." That text goes in a slightly different direction. One of the things Arjuna particularly worries about is that the family is disrupted. People marry the wrong people, and the order of the family and the social order and the caste system is disrupted. But it has some of the same sense, which is that if righteousness or appropriate action within a community or a nation goes wrong, the whole system crumbles, and once again, there's a rightness to the social order that can be maintained when there's righteousness among those in power. The conclusion of that text is quite different from this one. Krishna says, "You're wrong. It's appropriate to go to war, but you have to remember that, you know, you and your army and their army are all already dead because I am time itself and I have devoured everything already. And you're just playing your part in the cosmic drama, as it were." The thing to do, actually, is to attain a kind of profound devotion to me and a dissolving of the separate self. And then you won't understand the world with this same confusion. You'll be liberated. Here, the text, it doesn't make that leap into what we might hear in some of the other Buddhist texts, a leap toward the kind of abstractions of the liberation teachings. Here, it simply says, when the leader goes astray, everything else goes wrong. When the leader stays righteous or ethical, everything else goes with. And so then we might think about the place in our own practice for, since none of us is the king, as far as I can tell, here, except of your own castle, which of course you are, perhaps. We're all somewhere down that chain of influence from a leader that, at least in this country at this moment, many folks, including myself, consider quite unrighteous. But that's been true for a long time. In a certain way, I don't even need to pick on the current president, but I could say, you know, aspects of the system that we're in simply are unrighteous, and then everyone who participates suffers from that in various ways. What do we do with that in our own practice? There is a way that when I read this teaching and I'm reminded of the centrality of righteousness or ethics and how it, in a certain way, influences everything around it, and I notice myself as a subject in the classical sense, as in, you know, the subject of a regime. I'm subject to an unrighteous regime right now. My choice then, as a practitioner who longs for well-being, has an aspect of renunciation in it. There's a little bit where I have to resist the system, and I say, well, even though those who are in the position of moral authority are amoral or immoral, I should say immoral right now, some are amoral, some are immoral, I will resist that, and I actually choose to try to maintain an ethical center, even though the system around me is unethical. And that in a way, is part of what we are asked to do as practitioners. Right? Oh, the world around is lost in greed and hatred and delusion much of the time. What can you do, you know, staying close to people that you consider wise, gathering with good friends, staying inspired with material that is moral and wholesome, uplifting, liberating. One of my teachers calls this being an island of coherence in the world. Like in your friend group or in your city or in your field, whatever it is. Whatever the dynamic going on, you might be in a very righteous cohort at work or in your community or in your family around really good people. And you might not be. You might be in a place where there's lots of wounding and suffering and therefore lots of acting on greed, hatred, and delusion. And your practice then, the heart of contemplative practice is in a way to use mindfulness and some concentration and loving kindness, intention, the kind of building blocks of practice to in a sense hold your ground for goodness in the world. This is a fierce action in the world that doesn't even have to become kind of activist, like try to do anything outward, but just living by the precepts, living by the intention to not cause harm or to take care with our actions, already does what the Buddha calls going against the stream. It pushes against the culture around us, the aspects of the culture around us that lean in the direction of the unrighteous. So that's one thing that I think we must do is find even a moral center. Who do we listen to for a moral center? Then how do we find that in ourselves? And hold to that, even if the king and the vassals and those in power are unrighteous and the weather is going off as a result of that. A second thing we can do is this piece of associating with the wise. So like, that's the sort of not my president, hashtag not my president maneuver. Like, okay, the ruler in this particular way is unrighteous, but I take as my ruler something else, you know, a teacher or a guide or a public figure that is righteous. And I, you know, like, okay, the halls of power are fairly toxic, but, you know, Barbara Lee speaks for me. Like, I have my one kind of ethical, fierce defender of goodness, my local representative. So that's a second way that we can do it, is we actually shift our sense of who the ruler is, in a way. Say, I follow this, I follow these people who are good. And then you gather with good people and you try to have some momentum in building community. That's the building community piece. A third response, I think, is the place we started in the meditation tonight, which is the compassionate response. To whatever degree I find a center of groundedness and wholesomeness in myself, there may also be, there must be a decrease then in greed, hatred, and delusion in my own field. Because wholesomeness and hatred are incompatible, right? Renunciation and greed are incompatible. Clear seeing and delusion are incompatible. Love and hatred are incompatible. So cultivating righteousness decreases the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. As I do that, I get a little breathing space from their kind of crushing embrace. And what becomes possible is to see the suffering of others and not be swept under because my own is so extreme. I get a little lift from the torment of my own situation, and I'm able to look around and see, and I see like, oh, this entire town burned to the ground, and you know, these people are suffering in these ways, and these people in these ways. And when it's not affected by fear or scarcity or contraction around its own, what it considers to be mine or myself, my people, the natural response of the heart is to care. And so then we care, and there's the compassionate response that so often shows up. Disasters are great for this because, stuff is going down in your life, it's challenging, but, you know, your entire town didn't just burn down, unless you're from Paradise, at which point it did, I'm so sorry, that's the case. But disasters are good for this. If you're in it, then you're in it, and that's fierce, and community shows up, and it's dangerous, and hopefully not that common. And if you're not in it, then you get to, from the relative ease of your position, relax and actually feel and act on compassion for those suffering. We don't need the disaster to do that. But in the cultivation of compassion, it's actually, it can be a way to practice, right? If what compassion is the heart tender and caring and opening in the face of others' suffering. One of the ways to do that is to bring to mind an image of some suffering that you can feel, but is a little bit distant, so that you don't get swept under in the story yourself. But you can really just radiate that kindness. Oh, may this be eased. And what we're going for isn't like, you know, that I know exactly what to do about it. I don't know exactly what to do, you know, about the California fire season now, under climate change and forestry conditions and political conditions and population conditions. And like, it's so complex. There are some good ideas that are hard to put into place. So then what I have left to do is I care. It's my state, there's people suffering. And this is the cultivation that we are going for in the contemplative side, which is that compassion as a state, as a dwelling place of the mind or heart, becomes one of our homes that we could rest into and soften into. Even though it's a contact with suffering, there's a kind of poignant tenderness that can be very sweet, actually, and connective and relational and loving. And then we begin to be able to act from that place rather than, again, from perpetuating the greed, hatred, and delusion that comes down from on high. Doing so may not repair the ecosystem. And in a way, you know, some of the deepest compassion work we can do is to reflect in a clear-eyed way about the planet that our generations are leaving for the generations to come. And it's a deep reflection on impermanence and change but also righteousness and unrighteousness, that we've got to this position where, you know, our children and their children's generations will almost certainly at this point be living in a world where the winds blow off course and at random, the seasons and years proceed off course, the deities become upset, sufficient rain does not fall, crops ripen irregularly, and the people are short-lived, weak, unhealthy. And there's such a terrible but very real and deep piece of work for us as practitioners to do, to actually face the world as it is and what's fixable and what's not, and to not lose that moral center, to not lose the ability to feel and to act from feeling, no matter how dire the situation, no matter how unrighteous the rulers have become. So, any thoughts or questions here on this text, on this realm, this moment that we're in, or anything about your practice in general?
Sort of teased this in the beginning, so we knew we'd be talking about compassion tonight. And then after your reading, I assumed that that we would be learning to feel compassion for the unrighteous ruler, as opposed to the subjects of the unrighteous ruler.
Yeah.
Which, and I'm sure you're not opposed to that, but it's not a harder practice, obviously. But
indeed,
can you speak to that a little bit? But, I mean, if we're all suffering from greed, hatred, and delusion.
Yeah.
And someone just has a larger microphone.
Seriously. Okay. Compassion for the unrighteous ruler is a very good practice. It's heavy, you know. It's not that difficult, actually. Once you do what you just did, which is say, like, oh, everyone's suffering from greed, hatred, and delusion, like, if we look at our rulers, the really unrighteous ones, like, do they look anything like happy? No. Like, we hear stories of their family life, and I'm just like, yikes. You know? It's actually pretty easy to feel compassion for them. Forgiveness is harder. But compassion's not that difficult in a certain way. Because the training is just to see suffering for what it is. And like, no one acts that way unless they're suffering. So compassion is one of the four Brahma-viharas, along with metta, loving-kindness, sympathetic joy or appreciative joy, and equanimity. And the process of practice for all of them is the same, right, that we've done many times in here, where you start with, like, sending love to people you like, and then to people that are neutral, and then to people that are difficult, and then working out to all beings. And the idea seems to be that it's possible, with some concentration and persistence, to generate a feeling, an emotion, in a relational way, which is the usual way that they thrive. It's like, oh, well, I like you because we're friends. And then I kind of take that, I learn how to generate that feeling of liking people that I like, and then send it to people that I don't know, and then eventually to all beings. And the training is like, well, could I do that with difficult people? Could I actually be like, okay, well, here's this feeling that I have for my friends who I like, or my family, or my people I respect. And it turns out that it's actually possible to kind of unhook the feeling, which is basically a physical state of pleasure and connectedness, from the story or the idea of the person they're connected to. It's like you think about the people you love and you're just like, oh, that's like, you know, basically good people, but they're suffering. Oh, I wish they wouldn't suffer, because why would I want them to suffer? You know. And then all you do is you put the difficult person in that place and you're like, ah, basically good person, like in a fundamental sense, you know, suffering. Why would I want them to suffer? Like, if they weren't suffering, they also wouldn't be behaving so badly. But that shouldn't be your motivation, I think, to be like, oh, may you not suffer so that you stop being a jerk. I think it's purer if it's just like, you're suffering, may you not suffer, period. Because then why would you want that? So during, when I was doing intensive metta practice, it was in the kind of 02, 03, 04, 05 kind of period of my practice. So for all the times that I did kind of long Brahma Vihara practice, a month or two of metta practice at a time, it was all during the George W. Bush presidency. So cheers to unrighteous rulers, the old kind, you know, who now look sort of cute, just painting pictures of dogs. And themselves in the bathtub, which is weird, but not, you know, not as we had no idea what was coming, some of us. But he was my difficult person, you know, for metta and compassion practice. And it's totally a practice to be like, okay, may you be free from suffering. And a lot of the time, it's like, may you be free from suffering. You terrible. I was, in different language than this, like, are you a terrible person? I don't like what you're doing at all. But may you be free from suffering. And just hanging out with that is the practice. So that's the practice for developing the sense of compassion for all beings, is that it has to include everybody, including the unrighteous ruler. Compassion is such an interesting state or feeling, because it comes in a lot of different flavors. It very, very often has this beautiful mix of being very, very loving, but also really sees or feels suffering. So there's a kind of, it's kind of loving and painful at the same time. Like, to really care about someone who's suffering is a kind of uplifted or divine state. But there's a sort of radiance in it if you are clear enough in yourself to not let it kind of take you down. And there's that there's these amazing images. The compassion deities always get the most amazing postures. One of the postures that's so gorgeous is a one of the classical shapes taken by Kuan Yin, one of the bodhisattvas or goddesses of compassion. And there's a posture called Royal Ease, where she has one foot, she's sitting on a more like a chair than before. One leg is off, stepping down, and the other arm is up, and she's just sitting like this, in this kind of like upright and graceful posture, but not deep in meditation. Eyes open, looking out. And there's one of the translations of the name Kuan Yin from the Chinese Quan Shi Yin, which is a transliteration of the Sanskrit Avalokiteshvara, is the one who listens to or hears the sounds of the world while resting at ease. And So the one who hears the cries of the world, who and the Mahayana texts really kind of flesh out this listening to wailing and lamentation and suffering, and both being the quality of caring so deeply, but also resting back, resting in a kind of easeful seat. So that's this kind of paradoxical contact and equanimity that that's suggested in the compassion teachings. So I think about how could that be useful for us in a time when calamity in a certain way may be upon us in a way that is irreversible in certain ways. I'm glad you mentioned it. Those unrighteous rulers. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Is probably a metaphor that is convenient to unload the responsibility of ourselves to the event. I think that we're all responsible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a view that's.
It's a difficult view.
Well,
but it's collective
trauma. Yeah, you know, you get the president you deserve, they say.
The election.
Yeah, right? So there is a way that this is true also in the early texts that, you know, it's not that it's just that, you know, everything was good and then a single unrighteous person arose and poisoned the whole batch. It all goes together, right? It's talking about the influence the leader has, but you know, when we put it into the present day, I think I go very much to the place that you're speaking, where I think about it's not accurate to think of, you know, the president or the king or something as the end of the line with that thing, because you know, that person is subject to, you know, the deeper king, which we might call, you know, money or power, mm-hmm. right? In a sense, you know, there's a part of me that has a particular economic critique might say, oh, capitalism as king mm-hmm. is unrighteous or has been behaving unrighteously and that has been spreading. Mm-hmm. Or we might say, you know, colonialism or, you know, kind of imperialism as king has been, and then the particular kings, you know, whoever they are, right? Trump, Trudeau, Macron, May, Putin are just actually vassals. They're high up, but they're not the end, mm-hmm. and the end is this system that's actually unwholesome, mm-hmm. in some way, and. Now we can take the whole thing and make all of this a metaphor for the internal. The opening verse of the Dhammapada, the sayings of the Buddha, is mind is the forerunner of all things, mind is chief. And so it actually puts mind in the position of the king. So what if all of this is a kind of internal psychology? When the mind, or the core, the heart consciousness, is unrighteous, then then the internal story is unrighteous, and the ego and its structures are unrighteous, and then the physical actions that unfold are unrighteous, and then the seasons go off course. And we can understand in a way that it's pointing to the influence that these kind of nodes of power have. But that what you're saying about a collective, the collective really holding the karmic force in a way, feels both true, and it's one of the pathways toward action. Like, you know, if lots of people together decide to do something differently, the leaders can't maintain something that's unrighteous in the face of of enough popular resistance. And so so vote, basically. You know, get righteous, but get righteous, you know, with the people, and then the people have a collective karma toward more goodness, and then we work in the direction of that.
We won one of the houses.
And we won one of the houses, totally. Just this morning, another Senate seat went blue, which is excellent, in Arizona. So, bit by bit, you know, swinging back and forth. But there you go. The collective karma of this place is thick. So the story is far from over. May the righteous rulers appear more often, let's say. That's a closing prayer. And guide the people across the river at the ford without going astray. Cool. All right. Thanks for being here on a smoky night. Wear your masks and keep your lungs safe. Thanks for your donations, supporting the group. Just gratitude for your generosity and just for your presence all these weeks and weeks chatting together. Pleasure. So see you next week.